many hymns, but when Mary played it, the sound was nothing like that formless clunking. It was liquid. It was air. It was rock one moment and wind the next. The next day, when Mary returned from the school, I asked her if, instead of money, she would give me lessons. We perched on the piano bench, and she showed me a few finger exercises. Then she asked what else I was learning besides the piano. Dad had told me what to say when people asked about my schooling. "I do school every day," I said. "Do you meet other kids?" she asked. "Do you have friends?" "Sure," I said. Mary returned to the lesson. When we'd finished and I was ready to go, she said, "My sister Caroline teaches dance every Wednesday in the back of Papa J's. There are a lot of girls your age. You could join." That Wednesday, I left Randy's early and pedaled to the gas station. I wore jeans, a large gray t-shirt, and steel-toed boots. The other girls wore black leotards and sheer, shimmering skirts, white tights, and tiny ballet shoes the color of taffy. Caroline was younger than Mary. Her makeup was flawless, and gold hoops flashed through chestnut curls. She arranged us in rows, then showed us a short routine. A song played from a boombox in the corner. I'd never heard it before, but the other girls knew it. I looked in the mirror at our reflection, at the 12 girls, sleek and shiny, pirouetting blurs of black, white, and pink. Then at myself, large and gray. When the lesson finished, Caroline told me to buy a leotard and dance shoes. "I can't," I said. "Oh," she looked uncomfortable. "Maybe one of the girls can lend you one." She'd misunderstood. She thought I didn't have money. "It isn't modest," I said. Her lips parted in surprise. "These Californian moils," I thought. "Well, you can't dance in boots," she said. "I'll talk to your mother." A few days later, Mother drove me 40 miles to a small shop whose shelves were lined with exotic shoes and strange acrylic costumes. Not one was modest. Mother went straight to the counter and told the attendant we needed a black leotard, white tights, and jazz shoes. "Keep those in your room," Mother said as we left the store. She didn't need to say anything else. I already understood that I should not show the leotard to Dad. That Wednesday, I wore the leotard and tights with my gray t-shirt over the top. The t-shirt reached almost to my knees, but even so, I was ashamed to see so much of my legs. Dad said a righteous woman never shows anything above her ankle. The other girls rarely spoke to me, but I loved being there with them. I loved the sensation of conformity. Learning to dance felt like learning to belong. I could memorize the movements and, in doing so, step into their minds, lunging when they lunged, reaching my arms upward in time with theirs. Sometimes, when I glanced at the mirror and saw the tangle of our twirling forms, I could immediately discern myself in the crowd. It didn't matter that I was wearing a gray t-shirt, a goose among swans. We moved together, a single flock. We began rehearsals for the Christmas recital, and Caroline called Mother to discuss the costume. "The skirt will be how long?" Mother said. "And sheer? No, that's not going to work." I heard Caroline say something about what the other girls in the class would want to wear. "Tara can't wear that," Mother said. "If that's what the other girls are wearing, she will stay home." On the Wednesday after Caroline called Mother, I arrived at Papa J's a few minutes early. The younger class had just finished, and the store was flooded with six-year-olds, prancing for their mothers in red velvet hats and skirts sparkling with sequins of deep scarlet. I watched them wiggle and leap through the aisles, their thin legs covered only by sheer tights. I thought they looked like tiny harlots. The rest of my class arrived. When they saw the outfits, they rushed into the studio to see what Caroline had for them. Caroline was standing next to a cardboard box full of large gray sweatshirts. She began handing them out. "Here are your costumes," she said. The girls held up their sweatshirts, eyebrows raised in disbelief. They had expected chiffon or ribbon, not fruit of the loom. Caroline had tried to make the sweatshirts more appealing by sewing large Santas bordered with glitter on the fronts, but this only made the dingy cotton seem dingier. Mother hadn't told Dad about the recital, and neither had I. I didn't ask him to come. There was an instinct at work in me, a learned intuition. The day of the recital, Mother told Dad I had a thing that night. Dad asked a lot of questions, which surprised Mother, and after a few minutes, she admitted it was a dance recital. Dad grimaced when Mother told him I'd been taking lessons from Caroline Moyle, and I thought he was going to start talking about California socialism again, but he didn't. Instead, he got his coat, and the three of us walked to the car. The recital was held at the church. Everyone was there, with flashing cameras and bulky camcorders. I changed into my costume in the same room where I attended Sunday school. The other girls chatted cheerfully. I pulled on my sweatshirt, trying to stretch the material a few more inches. I was still tugging it downward when we lined up on the stage. Music played from a stereo on the piano, and we began to dance, our feet tapping in sequence. Next, we were supposed to leap, reach upward, and spin. My feet remained planted. Instead of flinging my arms above my head, I lifted them only to my shoulders. When the other girls crouched to slap the stage, I tilted. When we were to cartwheel, I swayed, refusing to allow gravity to do its work, to draw the sweatshirt any higher up my legs. The music ended. The girls glared at me as we left the stage. I had ruined the performance, but I could barely see them. Only one person in that room felt real to me, and that was Dad. I searched the audience and recognized him easily. He was standing in the back, the lights from the stage flickering off his square glasses. His expression was stiff, impassive, but I could see anger in it. The drive home was only a mile. It felt like 100. I sat in the back seat and listened to my father shout. How could Mother have let me sin so openly? Was this why she'd kept the recital from him? Mother listened for a moment, chewing her lip, then threw her hands in the air and said that she'd had no idea the costume would be so immodest. I'm furious with Caroline Moyle, she said. I leaned forward to see Mother's face, wanting her to look at me, to see the question I was mentally asking her because I didn't understand, not at all. I knew Mother wasn't furious with Caroline because I knew Mother had seen the sweatshirt days before. She had even called Caroline and thanked her for choosing a costume I could wear. Mother turned her head toward the window. I stared at the gray hairs on the back of Dad's head. He was sitting quietly, listening to Mother, who continued to insult Caroline, to say how shocking the costumes were, how obscene. Dad nodded as we bumped up the icy driveway, becoming less angry with every word from Mother. The rest of the night was taken up by my father's lecture. He said Caroline's class was one of Satan's deceptions, like the public school, because it claimed to be one thing when really it was another. It claimed to teach dance, but instead it taught immodesty, promiscuity. Satan was shrewd, Dad said. By calling it dance, he had convinced good Mormons to accept the sight of their daughters jumping about like whores in the Lord's house. That fact offended Dad more than anything else, that such a lewd display had taken place in a church. After he had worn himself out and gone to bed, I crawled under my covers and stared into the black. There was a knock at my door. It was Mother.
I should have known better, she said. I should have seen that class for what it was.
Mother must have felt guilty after the recital, because in the weeks that followed, she searched for something else I could do, something Dad wouldn't forbid. She'd noticed the hours I spent in my room with Tyler's old boombox, listening to the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, so she began looking for a voice teacher. It took a few weeks to find one, and another few weeks to persuade the teacher to take me. The lessons were much more expensive than the dance class had been, but Mother paid for them with the money she made selling oils. The teacher was tall and thin, with long fingernails that clicked as they flew across the piano keys. She straightened my posture by pulling the hair at the base of my neck until I'd tucked in my chin. Then she stretched me out on the floor and stepped on my stomach to strengthen my diaphragm. She was obsessed with balance and often slapped my knees to remind me to stand powerfully, to take up my own space. After a few lessons, she announced that I was ready to sing in church. It was arranged, she said. I would sing a hymn in front of the congregation that Sunday. The days slipped away quickly, as days do when you're dreading something. On Sunday morning, I stood at the pulpit and stared into the faces of the people below. There was Myrna and Papa Jay, and behind them Mary and Caroline. They looked sorry for me, like they thought I might humiliate myself. Mother played the introduction. The music paused. It was time to sing. I might have had any number of thoughts at that moment. I might have thought of my teacher and her techniques, square stance, straight back, dropped jaw. Instead, I thought of Tyler, and of lying on the carpet next to his desk, staring at his woolen-socked feet while the Mormon Tabernacle Choir chanted and trilled. He'd filled my head with their voices, which to me were more beautiful than anything except Buck's Peak. Mother's fingers hovered over the keys. The pause had become awkward. The congregation shifted uncomfortably. I thought of the voices, of their strange contradictions, of the way they made sound float on air, of how that sound was soft like a warm wind, but so sharp it pierced. I reached for those voices, reached into my mind, and there they were. Nothing had ever felt so natural. It was as if I thought the sound, and by thinking it, brought it into being. But reality had never yielded to my thoughts before. The song finished, and I returned to our pew. A prayer was offered to close the service. Then the crowd rushed me. Women in floral prints smiled and clasped my hand. Men in square black suits clapped my shoulder. The choir director invited me to join the choir. Brother Davis asked me to sing for the Rotary Club, and the bishop, the Mormon equivalent of a pastor, said he'd like me to sing my song at a funeral. I said yes to all of them. Dad smiled at everyone. There was scarcely a person in the church that Dad hadn't called a Gentile, for visiting a doctor or for sending their kids to the public school, but that day he seemed to forget about California socialism and the Illuminati. He stood next to me, a hand on my shoulder, graciously collecting compliments.
"We're very blessed," he kept saying. "Very blessed."
Papa Jay crossed the chapel and paused in front of our pew. He said I sang like one of God's own angels. Dad looked at him for a moment. Then his eyes began to shine, and he shook Papa Jay's hand like they were old friends. I'd never seen this side of my father, but I would see it many times after, every time I sang. However long he'd worked in the junkyard, he was never too tired to drive across the valley to hear me. However bitter his feelings toward socialists like Papa Jay, they were never so bitter that, should those people praise my voice, Dad wouldn't put aside the great battle he was fighting against the Illuminati long enough to say, "Yes, God has blessed us. We're very blessed." It was as if, when I sang, Dad forgot for a moment that the world was a frightening place, that it would corrupt me, that I should be kept safe, sheltered, at home. He wanted my voice to be heard. The theater in town was putting on a play, Annie, and my teacher said that if the director heard me sing, he would give me the lead. Mother warned me not to get my hopes up. She said we couldn't afford to drive the 12 miles to town 4 nights a week for rehearsals, and that even if we could, Dad would never allow me to spend time in town, alone, with who knows what kind of people. I practiced the songs anyway, because I liked them. One evening, I was in my room singing "The Sun'll Come Out Tomorrow" when Dad came in for supper. He chewed his meatloaf quietly and listened.
"I'll find the money," he told Mother when they went to bed that night. "You get her to that audition."
Chapter 9. Perfect in His Generations. The summer I sang the lead for Annie, it was 1999. My father was in serious preparedness mode. Not since I was 5 and the Weavers were under siege had he been so certain that the days of abomination were upon us. Dad called it Y2K. On January 1st, he said, computer systems all over the world would fail. There would be no electricity, no telephones. All would sink into chaos, and this would usher in the second coming of Christ. How do you know the day? I asked. Dad said that the government had programmed the computers with a 6-digit calendar, which meant the year had only 2 digits.
When 99 becomes 00, he said, the computers won't know what year it is. They'll shut down.
Can't they fix it?
Nope, can't be done, Dad said. Man trusted his own strength, and his strength was weak.
At church, Dad warned everyone about Y2K. He advised Papa Jay to get strong locks for his gas station and maybe some defensive weaponry.
That store will be the first thing looted in the famine, Dad said.
He told Brother Mumford that every righteous man should have, at minimum, a 10-year supply of food, fuel, guns, and gold. Brother Mumford just whistled.
We can't all be as righteous as you, Jean, he said. Some of us are sinners.
No one listened. They went about their lives in the summer sun. Meanwhile, my family boiled and skinned peaches, pitted apricots, and churned apples into sauce. Everything was pressure-cooked, sealed, labeled, and stored away in a root cellar Dad had dug out in the field. The entrance was concealed by a hillock. Dad said I should never tell anybody where it was. One afternoon, Dad climbed into the excavator and dug a pit next to the old barn. Then, using the loader, he lowered a 1,000-gallon tank into the pit and buried it with a shovel, carefully planting nettles and sow thistle in the freshly tossed dirt so they would grow and conceal the tank. He whistled, "I Feel Pretty" from West Side Story while he shoveled. His hat was tipped back on his head, and he wore a brilliant smile.
"We'll be the only ones with fuel when the end comes," he said. "We'll be driving when everyone else is hot-footing it. We'll even make a run down to Utah to fetch Tyler."
I had rehearsals most nights at the Worm Creek Opera House, a dilapidated theater near the only stoplight in town. The play was another world. Nobody talked about Y2K. The interactions between people at Worm Creek were not at all what I was used to in my family. Of course I'd spent time with people outside my family, but they were like us, women who'd hired mother to midwife their babies, or who came to her for herbs because they didn't believe in the medical establishment. I had a single friend named Jessica. A few years before, Dad had convinced her parents, Rob and Diane, that public schools were little more than government propaganda programs, and since then they had kept her at home. Before her parents had pulled Jessica from school, she was one of them, and I never tried to talk to her. But after, she was one of us. The normal kids stopped including her, and she was left with me. I'd never learned how to talk to people who weren't like us, people who went to school and visited the doctor, who weren't preparing every day for the end of the world. Worm Creek was full of these people, people whose words seemed ripped from another reality. That was how it felt the first time the director spoke to me, like he was speaking from another dimension. All he said was, "Go find FDR. I didn't move. He tried again. "President Roosevelt, FDR.
"Is that like a JCB?" I said. "You need a forklift?"
Everyone laughed. I'd memorized all my lines, but at rehearsals I sat alone, pretending to study my black binder. When it was my turn on stage, I would recite my lines loudly and without hesitation. That made me feel a kind of confidence. If I didn't have anything to say, at least Annie did. A week before opening night, Mother dyed my brown hair cherry red. The director said it was perfect, that all I needed now was to finish my costumes before the dress rehearsal on Saturday. In our basement, I found an oversized knit sweater, stained and hole-ridden, and an ugly blue dress, which Mother bleached to a faded brown. The dress was perfect for an orphan, and I was relieved at how easy finding the costumes had been, until I remembered that in Act Two, Annie wears beautiful dresses, which Daddy Warbucks buys for her. I didn't have anything like that. I told Mother, and her face sank. We drove 100 miles round trip, searching every second-hand shop along the way, but found nothing. Sitting in the parking lot of the last shop, Mother pursed her lips, then said, "There's one more place we can try." She drove to my Aunt Angie's and parked in front of the white picket fence she shared with Grandma. Mother knocked, then stood back from the door and smoothed her hair. Angie looked surprised to see us. Mother rarely visited her sister, but she smiled warmly and invited us in. Her front room reminded me of fancy hotel lobbies from the movies. There was so much silk and lace. Mother and I sat on a pleated sofa of pale pink while Mother explained why we'd come. Angie said her daughter had a few dresses that might do. Mother waited on the pink sofa while Angie led me upstairs to her daughter's room and laid out an armful of dresses, each so fine, with such intricate lace patterns and delicately tied bows, that at first I was afraid to touch them. Angie helped me into each one, knotting the sashes, fastening the buttons, plumping the bows. "You should take this one," she said, passing me a navy dress with white braided cords arranged across the bodice. "Grandma sewed this detailing." I took the dress, along with another made of red velvet, collared with white lace, and Mother and I drove home. The play opened a week later. Dad was in the front row. When the performance ended, he marched right to the box office and bought tickets for the next night. It was all he talked about that Sunday in church, not doctors or the Illuminati or Y2K, just the play over in town where his youngest daughter was singing the lead. Dad didn't stop me from auditioning for the next play, or the one after that, even though he worried about me spending so much time away from home.
"There's no telling what kind of cavorting takes place in that theater," he said. "It's probably a den of adulterers and fornicators."
When the director of the next play got divorced, it confirmed Dad's suspicions. He said he hadn't kept me out of the public school for all these years just to see me corrupted on a stage. Then he drove me to the rehearsal. Nearly every night he said he was going to put a stop to my going, that one evening he'd just show up at Worm Creek and haul me home. But each time a play opened, he was there, in the front row. Sometimes he played the part of an agent or manager, correcting my technique or suggesting songs for my repertoire, even advising me about my health. That winter, I caught a procession of sore throats and couldn't sing, and one night, Dad called me to him and pried my mouth open to look at my tonsils.
"They're swollen, all right," he said. "Big as apricots."
When Mother couldn't get the swelling down with echinacea and calendula, Dad suggested his own remedy.
"People don't know it, but the sun is the most powerful medicine we have. That's why people don't get sore throats in summer."
He nodded, as if approving of his own logic, then said,
"If I had tonsils like yours, I'd go outside every morning and stand in the sun with my mouth open. Let those rays seep in for a half hour or so. They'll shrink in no time."
He called it a treatment. I did it for a month. It was uncomfortable, standing with my jaw dropped and my head tilted back so the sun could shine into my throat. I never lasted a whole half hour. My jaw would ache after 10 minutes, and I'd half freeze standing motionless in the Idaho winter. I kept catching more sore throats, and any time Dad noticed I was a bit croaky, he'd say,
"Well, what do you expect? I ain't seen you getting treatment all week."
It was at the Worm Creek Opera House that I first saw him, a boy I didn't know laughing with a group of public school kids, wearing big white shoes, khaki shorts, and a wide grin. He wasn't in the play, but there wasn't much to do in town, and I saw him several more times that week when he turned up to visit his friends. Then, one night, when I was wandering alone in the dark wings backstage, I turned a corner and found him sitting on the wooden crate that was a favorite haunt of mine. The crate was isolated. That was why I liked it. He shifted to the right, making room for me. I sat slowly, tensely, as if the seat were made of needles. "I'm Charles," he said. There was a pause while he waited for me to give my name, but I didn't.
"I saw you in the last play," he said after a moment. "I wanted to tell you something."
I braced myself, for what I wasn't sure. Then he said,
"I wanted to tell you that your singing is about the best I ever heard."
I came home one afternoon from packing macadamias to find Dad and Richard gathered around a large metal box which they'd hefted onto the kitchen table. While Mother and I cooked meatloaf, they assembled the contents. It took more than an hour, and when they'd finished, they stood back, revealing what looked like an enormous, military-green telescope with its long barrel set firmly atop a short, broad tripod. Richard was so excited he was hopping from one foot to the other, reciting what it could do.
"Got a range more than a mile. Can bring down a helicopter."
Dad stood quietly, his eyes shining.
"What is it?" I asked.
"It's a 50 caliber rifle," he said. "Want to try it?"
I peered through the scope, searching the mountainside, fixing distant stalks of wheat between its crosshairs. The meatloaf was forgotten. We charged outside. It was past sunset. The horizon was dark. I watched as Dad lowered himself to the frozen ground, positioned his eye at the scope, and after what felt like an hour, pulled the trigger. The blast was thunderous. I had both palms pressed to my ears, but after the initial boom, I dropped them, listening as the shot echoed through the ravines. He fired again and again, so that by the time we went inside, my ears were ringing. I could barely hear Dad's reply when I asked what the gun was for.
"Defense," he said.
The next night, I had a rehearsal at Worm Creek. I was perched on my crate, listening to the monologue being performed on stage, when Charles appeared and sat next to me.
"You don't go to school," he said.
It wasn't a question.
"You should come to choir. You'd like choir."
"Maybe," I said, and he smiled.
A few of his friends stepped into the wing and called to him. He stood and said goodbye, and I watched him join them, taking in the easy way they joked together and imagining an alternate reality in which I was one of them. I imagined Charles inviting me to his house to play a game or watch a movie and felt a rush of pleasure. But when I pictured Charles visiting Buck's Peak, I felt something else. Something like panic. What if he found the root cellar? What if he discovered the fuel tank? Then I understood, finally, what the rifle was for. That mighty barrel, with its special range that could reach from the mountain to the valley, was a defensive perimeter for the house, for our supplies, because Dad said we would be driving when everyone else was hot-footing it. We would have food, too, when everyone else was starving, looting. Again, I imagined Charles climbing the hill to our house, but in my imagination, I was on the ridge, and I was watching his approach through crosshairs. Christmas was sparse that year. We weren't poor. Mother's business was doing well, and Dad was still scrapping, but we'd spent everything on supplies. Before Christmas, we continued our preparations as if every action, every minor addition to our stores might make the difference between surviving and not. After Christmas, we waited.
"When the hour of need arises," Dad said, "the time of preparation has passed."
The days dragged on, and then it was December 31st. Dad was calm at breakfast, but under his tranquility, I sensed excitement and something like longing. He'd been waiting for so many years, burying guns and stockpiling food and warning others to do the same. Everyone at church had read the prophecies. They knew the days of abomination were coming. But still, they'd teased Dad. They'd laughed at him. Tonight, he would be vindicated. After dinner, Dad studied Isaiah for hours. At around 10, he closed his Bible and turned on the TV. The television was new. Aunt Angie's husband worked for a satellite TV company, and he'd offered Dad a deal on a subscription. No one had believed it when Dad said yes, but in retrospect, it was entirely characteristic for my father to move, in the space of a day, from no TV or radio to full-blown cable. I sometimes wondered if Dad allowed the television that year, specifically because he knew it would all disappear on January 1st. Perhaps he did it to give us a little taste of the world before it was swept away. Dad's favorite program was The Honeymooners, and that night there was a special, with episodes playing back to back. We watched, waiting for the end. I checked the clock every few minutes from 10 until 11, then every few seconds until midnight. Even Dad, who was rarely stirred by anything outside himself, glanced often at the clock. 11:59. I held my breath. One more minute, I thought, before everything is gone. Then it was 12 o'clock. The TV was still buzzing, its lights dancing across the carpet. I wondered if our clock was fast. I went to the kitchen and turned on the tap. We had water. Dad stayed still, his eyes on the screen. I returned to the couch. 12:05. How long would it take for the electricity to fail? Was there a reserve somewhere that was keeping it going these few extra minutes? The black and white specters of Ralph and Alice Cramden argued over a meatloaf. 12:10. I waited for the screen to flicker and die. I was trying to take it all in, this last luxurious moment of sharp yellow light, of warm air flowing from the heater. I was experiencing nostalgia for the life I'd had before, which I would lose at any second when the world turned and began to devour itself. The longer I sat motionless, breathing deeply, trying to inhale the last scent of the fallen world, the more I resented its continuing solidity. Nostalgia turned to fatigue. Sometime after 1:30, I went to bed. I glimpsed Dad as I left, his face frozen in the dark, the light from the TV leaping across his square glasses. He sat as if posed, with no agitation, no embarrassment, as if there were a perfectly mundane explanation for why he was sitting up, alone, at near 2 in the morning, watching Ralph and Alice Cramden prepare for a Christmas party. He seemed smaller to me than he had that morning. The disappointment in his features was so childlike, for a moment I wondered how God could deny him this. He, a faithful servant, who suffered willingly just as Noah had willingly suffered to build the ark. But God withheld the flood. Chapter 10. Shield of Feathers. When January 1st dawned like any other morning, it broke Dad's spirit. He never again mentioned Y2K. He slipped into despondency, dragging himself in from the junkyard each night, silent and heavy. He'd sit in front of the TV for hours, a black cloud hovering. Mother said it was time for another trip to Arizona. Luke was serving a mission for the church, so it was just me, Richard, and Audrey who piled into the old Chevy Astro van Dad had fixed up. Dad removed the seats, except the two in front, and in their place he put a queen mattress. Then he heaved himself onto it and didn't move for the rest of the drive. As it had years before, the Arizona sun revived Dad. He lay out on the porch on the hard cement, soaking it up, while the rest of us read or watched TV. After a few days, he began to improve, and we braced ourselves for the nightly arguments between him and Grandma. Grandma was seeing a lot of doctors these days because she had cancer in her bone marrow.
"Those doctors will just kill you quicker," Dad said one evening when Grandma returned from a consultation.
Grandma refused to quit chemotherapy, but she did ask Mother about herbal treatments. Mother had brought some with her, hoping Grandma would ask, and Grandma tried them, foot soaks in red clay, cups of bitter parsley tea, tinctures of horsetail and hydrangea.
"Those herbs won't do a damned thing," Dad said. "Herbals operate by faith. You can't put your trust in a doctor, then ask the Lord to heal you."
Grandma didn't say a word. She just drank her parsley tea. I remember watching Grandma, searching for signs that her body was giving way. I didn't see any. She was the same taut, undefeated woman. The rest of the trip blurs in my memory, leaving me with only snapshots of Mother muscle-testing remedies for Grandma, of Grandma listening silently to Dad, of Dad sprawled out in the dry heat. Then I'm in a hammock on the back porch, rocking lazily in the orange light of the desert sunset, and Audrey appears and says, "Dad wants us to get our stuff. We're leaving." Grandma is incredulous.
"After what happened last time?" she shouts. "You're going to drive through the night again? What about the storm?"
Dad says we'll beat the storm. While we load the van, Grandma paces, cussing. She says Dad hasn't learned a damn thing. Richard drives the first 6 hours. I lie in the back on the mattress with Dad and Audrey. It's 3 in the morning, and we are making our way from southern to northern Utah when the weather changes from the dry chill of the desert to the freezing gales of an alpine winter. Ice claims the road. Snowflakes flick against the windshield like tiny insects, a few at first, then so many the road disappears. We push forward into the heart of the storm. The van skids and jerks. The wind is furious, the view out the window pure white. Richard pulls over. He says we can't go any further. Dad takes the wheel. Richard moves to the passenger seat, and Mother lies next to me and Audrey on the mattress. Dad pulls onto the highway and accelerates, rapidly, as if to make a point, until he has doubled Richard's speed.
"Shouldn't we drive slower?" Mother asks.
Dad grins.
"I'm not driving faster than our angels can fly."
The van is still accelerating, to 50, then to 60. Richard sits tensely, his hand clutching the armrest, his knuckles bleaching each time the tires slip. Mother lies on her side, her face next to mine, taking small sips of air each time the van fishtails, then holding her breath as Dad corrects and it snakes back into the lane. She is so rigid, I think she might shatter. My body tenses with hers. Together, we brace 100 times for impact. It is a relief when the van finally leaves the road. I awoke to blackness. Something ice cold was running down my back. "We're in a lake," I thought. Something heavy was on top of me, the mattress. I tried to kick it off, but couldn't, so I crawled beneath it, my hands and knees pressing into the ceiling of the van, which was upside down. I came to a broken window. It was full of snow. Then I understood. We were in a field, not a lake. I crawled through the broken glass and stood unsteadily. I couldn't seem to gain my balance. I looked around, but saw no one. The van was empty. My family was gone. I circled the wreck twice before I spied Dad's hunched silhouette on the hillock in the distance. I called to him, and he called to the others, who were spread out through the field. Dad waded toward me through the snowdrifts, and as he stepped into a beam from the broken headlights, I saw a 6-inch gash in his forearm and blood slashing into the snow. I was told later that I'd been unconscious, hidden under the mattress for several minutes. They'd shouted my name. When I didn't answer, they thought I must have been thrown from the van, through the broken window, so they'd left to search for me. Everyone returned to the wreck and stood around it awkwardly, shaking, either from the cold or from shock. We didn't look at Dad, didn't want to accuse. The police arrived, then an ambulance. I don't know who called them. I didn't tell them I'd lost consciousness. I was afraid they'd take me to a hospital. I just sat in the police car next to Richard, wrapped in a reflective blanket like the one I had in my Head for the Hills bag. We listened to the radio while the cops asked Dad why the van wasn't insured and why he'd removed the seats and seatbelts. We were far from Buck's Peak, so the cops took us to the nearest police station.
Dad called Tony, but Tony was trucking long haul. He tried Sean next. No answer. We would later learn that Sean was in jail that night, having been in some kind of brawl. Unable to reach his sons, Dad called Rob and Diane Hardy, because Mother had midwifed 5 of their 8 children. Rob arrived a few hours later, cackling.
"Didn't you folks damned near kill yourselves last time?"
A few days after the crash, my neck froze. I awoke one morning, and it wouldn't move. It didn't hurt, not at first, but no matter how hard I concentrated on turning my head, it wouldn't give more than an inch. The paralysis spread lower until it felt like I had a metal rod running through the length of my back and into my skull. When I couldn't bend forward or turn my head, the soreness set in. I had a constant, crippling headache, and I couldn't stand without holding on to something. Mother called an energy specialist named Rosie. I was lying on my bed, where I'd been for 2 weeks, when she appeared in the doorway, wavy and distorted, as if I were looking at her through a pool of water. Her voice was high in pitch, cheerful. It told me to imagine myself, whole and healthy, protected by a white bubble. Inside the bubble, I was to place all the objects I loved, all the colors that made me feel at peace. I envisioned the bubble. I imagined myself at its center, able to stand, to run. Behind me was a Mormon temple and Kamikaze, Luke's old goat, long dead. A green glow lighted everything.
"Imagine the bubble for a few hours every day," she said, "and you will heal."
She patted my arm, and I heard the door close behind her. I imagined the bubble every morning, afternoon, and night, but my neck remained immobile. Slowly, over the course of a month, I got used to the headaches. I learned how to stand, then how to walk. I used my eyes to stay upright. If I closed them for even a moment, the world would shift and I would fall. I went back to work, to Randy's, and occasionally to the junkyard. And every night I fell asleep imagining that green bubble. During the month I was in bed, I heard another voice. I remembered it, but it was no longer familiar to me. It had been 6 years since that impish laugh had echoed down the hall. It belonged to my brother Sean, who'd quarreled with my father at 17 and run off to work odd jobs, mostly trucking and welding. He'd come home because Dad had asked for his help. From my bed, I'd heard Sean say that he would only stay until Dad could put together a real crew. This was just a favor, he said, until Dad could get back on his feet. It was odd finding him in the house, this brother who was nearly a stranger to me. People in town seemed to know him better than I did. I'd heard rumors about him at Worm Creek. People said he was trouble, a bully, a bad egg, that he was always hunting or being hunted by hooligans from Utah or even further afield. People said he carried a gun, either concealed on his body or strapped to his big black motorcycle. Once someone said that Sean wasn't really bad, that he only got into brawls because he had a reputation for being unbeatable, for knowing all there was to know about martial arts, for fighting like a man who feels no pain. So every strung-out wannabe in the valley thought he could make a name for himself by besting him. It wasn't Sean's fault, really. As I listened to these rumors, he came alive in my mind as more legend than flesh. My own memory of Sean begins in the kitchen, perhaps 2 months after the second accident. I am making corn chowder. The door squeaks, and I twist at the waist to see who's come in, then twist back to chop an onion.
"You gonna be a walking popsicle stick forever?" Sean says.
"Nope."
"You need a chiropractor," he says.
"Mom'll fix it."
"You need a chiropractor," he says again.
The family eats, then disperses. I start the dishes. My hands are in the hot, soapy water when I hear a step behind me and feel thick, calloused hands wrap around my skull. Before I can react, he jerks my head with a swift, savage motion. Crack! It's so loud, I'm sure my head has come off and he's holding it. My body folds, I collapse. Everything is black, but somehow spinning. When I open my eyes moments later, his hands are under my arms, and he's holding me upright.
"Might be a while before you can stand," he says. "But when you can, I need to do the other side."
I was too dizzy, too nauseous for the effect to be immediate. But throughout the evening, I observed small changes. I could look at the ceiling. I could cock my head to tease Richard. Seated on the couch, I could turn to smile at the person next to me. That person was Sean, and I was looking at him, but I wasn't seeing him. I don't know what I saw, what creature I conjured from that violent, compassionate act, but I think it was my father, or perhaps my father as I wished he were, some longed-for defender, some fanciful champion, one who wouldn't fling me into a storm, and who, if I was hurt, would make me whole. Chapter 11. Instinct. When Grandpa down the hill was a young man, there'd been herds of livestock spread across the mountain, and they were tended on horseback. Grandpa's ranching horses were the stuff of legend. Seasoned as old leather, they moved their burly bodies delicately, as if guided by the rider's thoughts. At least, that's what I was told. I never saw them. As Grandpa got older, he ranched less and farmed more, until one day he stopped farming. He had no need for horses, so he sold the ones that had value and set the rest loose. They multiplied, and by the time I was born, there was a whole herd of wild horses on the mountain. Richard called them dog food horses. Once a year, Luke, Richard, and I would help Grandpa round up a dozen or so to take to the auction in town, where they'd be sold for slaughter. Some years Grandpa would look out over the small, frightened herd bound for the meat grinder, at the young stallions pacing, coming to terms with their first captivity, and a hunger would appear in his eyes. Then he'd point to one and say,
"Don't load that'n. That'n will break."
But feral horses don't yield easily, not even to a man like Grandpa. My brothers and I would spend days, even weeks, earning the horse's trust, just so we could touch it. Then we would stroke its long face, and gradually, over more weeks, work our hands around its wide neck and down its muscular body. After a month of this, we'd bring out the saddle, and the horse would toss its head suddenly and with such violence that the halter would snap or the rope break. Once a large copper stallion busted the corral fence, smashed through it as if it weren't there, and came out the other side bloody and bruised. We tried not to name them, these beasts we hoped to tame, but we had to refer to them somehow. The names we chose were descriptive, not sentimental. Big Red, Black Mare, White Giant. I was thrown from dozens of these horses as they bucked, reared, rolled, or leapt. I hit the dirt in 100 sprawling postures, each time righting myself in an instant and skittering to the safety of a tree, tractor, or fence, in case the horse was feeling vengeful. We never triumphed. Our strength of will faltered long before theirs. We got some so they wouldn't buck when they saw the saddle, and a few who'd tolerate a human on their back for jaunts around the corral, but not even Grandpa dared ride them on the mountain. Their natures hadn't changed. They were pitiless, powerful avatars from another world. To mount them was to surrender your footing, to move into their domain, to risk being borne away. The first domesticated horse I ever saw was a bay gelding, and it was standing next to the corral, nibbling sugar cubes from Sean's hand. It was spring, and I was 14. It had been many years since I'd touched a horse. The gelding was mine, a gift from a great uncle on my mother's side. I approached warily, certain that as I moved closer the horse would buck, or rear, or charge. Instead, it sniffed my shirt, leaving a long, wet stain. Sean tossed me a cube. The horse smelled the sugar, and the prickles from his chin tickled my fingers until I opened my palm.
"Want to break him?" Sean said.
I did not. I was terrified of horses, or I was terrified of what I thought horses were,
That is, thousand-pound devils whose ambition was to dash brains against rock. I told Sean he could break the horse. I would watch from the fence. I refused to name the horse, so we called him the Yearling. The Yearling was already broke to a halter and lead, so Sean brought out the saddle that first day. The Yearling pawed the dirt nervously when he saw it. Sean moved slowly, letting him smell the stirrups and nibble curiously at the horn. Then Sean rubbed the smooth leather across his broad chest, moving steadily, but without hurry.
"Horses don't like things where they can't see 'em," Sean said. "Best to get him used to the saddle in front. Then, when he's real comfortable with it, the way it smells and feels, we can move it around back."
An hour later, the saddle was cinched. Sean said it was time to mount, and I climbed onto the barn roof, sure the corral would descend into violence. But when Sean hoisted himself into the saddle, the Yearling merely skittered. His front hooves raised a few inches off the dirt, as if he'd pondered rearing, but thought better of it. Then he dropped his head, and his paws stilled. In the space of a moment, he had accepted our claim to ride him, to his being ridden. He had accepted the world as it was, in which he was an owned thing. He had never been feral, so he could not hear the maddening call of that other world on the mountain, in which he could not be owned, could not be ridden. I named him Bud. Every night for a week, I watched Sean and Bud gallop through the corral in the gray haze of dusk. Then, on a soft summer evening, I stood next to Bud, grasping the reins, while Sean held the halter steady and stepped into the saddle. Sean said he wanted out of his old life, and that the first step was to stay away from his friends. Suddenly, he was home every evening, looking for something to do. He began to drive me to my rehearsals at Worm Creek. When it was just the two of us floating down the highway, he was mellow, light-hearted. He joked and teased, and he sometimes gave me advice, which was mostly, "Don't do what I did." But when he arrived at the theater, he would change. At first, he watched the younger boys with wary concentration. Then he began to bait them. It wasn't obvious aggression, just small provocations. He might flick off a boy's hat or knock a soda can from his hand and laugh as the stains spread over the boy's jeans. If he was challenged, and he usually wasn't, he would play the part of the ruffian, a hardened, "what you gonna do about it" expression disguising his face. But after, when it was just the two of us, the mask lowered, the bravado peeled off like a breastplate, and he was my brother. It was his smile I loved best. His upper canines had never grown in, and the string of holistic dentists my parents had taken him to as a child had failed to notice until it was too late. By the time he was 23, and he got himself to an oral surgeon, they had rotated sideways inside his gums and were ejecting themselves through the tissue under his nose. The surgeon who removed them told Sean to preserve his baby teeth for as long as possible, then when they rotted out, he'd be given posts. But they never rotted out. They stayed, stubborn relics of a misplaced childhood, reminding anyone who witnessed his pointless, endless, feckless belligerence that this man was once a boy. It was a hazy summer evening, a month before I turned 15. The sun had dipped below Buck's Peak, but the sky still held a few hours of light. Sean and I were in the corral. After breaking Bud that spring, Sean had taken up horses in a serious way. All summer, he'd been buying horses, thoroughbreds and Paso Finos, most of them unbroken because he could pick them up cheap. We were still working with Bud. We'd taken him on a dozen rides through the open pasture, but he was inexperienced, skittish, unpredictable. That evening, Sean saddled a new horse, a copper-coated mare, for the first time. She was ready for a short ride, Sean said, so we mounted, him on the mare, me on Bud. We made it about half a mile up the mountain, moving deliberately so as not to frighten the horses, winding our way through the wheat fields. Then I did something foolish. I got too close to the mare.
She didn't like having the gelding behind her, and with no warning, she leapt forward, thrusting her weight onto her front legs, and with her hind legs, kicked Bud full in the chest. Bud went berserk. I'd been tying a knot in my reins to make them more secure and didn't have a firm hold. Bud gave a tremendous jolt, then began to buck, throwing his body in tight circles. The reins flew over his head. I gripped the saddle horn and squeezed my thighs together, curving my legs around his bulging belly. Before I could get my bearings, Bud took off at a dead run straight up a ravine, bucking now and then, but running, always running. My foot slipped through a stirrup up to my calf. All those summers breaking horses with Grandpa, and the only advice I remembered him giving was, "Whatever you do, don't get your foot caught in the stirrup." I didn't need him to explain. I knew that as long as I came off clean, I'd likely be fine. At least I'd be on the ground. But if my foot got caught, I'd be dragged until my head split on a rock. Sean couldn't help me, not on that unbroken mare. Hysteria in one horse causes hysteria in others, especially in the young and spirited. Of all Sean's horses, there was only one, a 7-year-old buckskin named Apollo, who might have been old enough and calm enough to do it, to explode in furious speed, a nostril-flapping gallop, then coolly navigate while the rider detached his body, lifting one leg out of the stirrup and reaching to the ground to catch the reins of another horse wild with fright. But Apollo was in the corral, half a mile down the mountain. My instincts told me to let go of the saddle horn, the only thing keeping me on the horse. If I let go, I'd fall, but I'd have a precious moment to reach for the flapping reins or try to yank my calf from the stirrup. "Make a play for it," my instinct screamed. Those instincts were my guardians. They had saved me before, guiding my movements on a dozen bucking horses, telling me when to cling to the saddle and when to pitch myself clear of pounding hooves. They were the same instincts that, years before, had prompted me to hoist myself from the scrap bin when Dad was dumping it, because they had understood, even if I had not, that it was better to fall from that great height rather than hope Dad would intervene. All my life, those instincts had been instructing me in this single doctrine, that the odds are better if you rely only on yourself. Bud reared, thrusting his head so high I thought he might tumble backward. He landed hard and bucked. I tightened my grip on the horn, making a decision, based on another kind of instinct, not to surrender my hold. Sean would catch up, even on that unbroken mare. He'd pull off a miracle. The mare wouldn't even understand the command when he shouted, "Giddy up!" At the jab of his boot in her gut, which she'd never felt before, she would rear, twisting wildly. But he would yank her head down, and as soon as her hooves touched the dirt, kick her a second time, harder, knowing she would rear again. He would do this until she leapt into a run. Then he would drive her forward, welcoming her wild acceleration, somehow guiding her, even though she'd not yet learned the strange dance of movements that, over time, becomes a kind of language between horse and rider. All this would happen in seconds, a year of training reduced to a single, desperate moment. I knew it was impossible. I knew it even as I imagined it, but I kept hold of the saddle horn. Bud had worked himself into a frenzy. He leapt wildly, arching his back as he shot upward, then tossing his head as he smashed his hooves to the ground. My eyes could barely unscramble what they saw. Golden wheat flew in every direction, while the blue sky and the mountain lurched absurdly. I was so disoriented that I felt, rather than saw, the powerful penny-toned mare moving into place beside me. Sean lifted his body from the saddle and tilted himself toward the ground, holding his reins tightly in one hand while, with the other, he snatched Bud's reins from the weeds. The leather straps pulled taut, the bit forced Bud's head up and forward. With his head raised, Bud could no longer buck, and he entered a smooth, rhythmic gallop. Sean yanked hard on his own reins, pulling the mare's head toward his knee, forcing her to run in a circle. He pulled her head tighter on every pass, wrapping the strap around his forearm, shrinking the circle until it was so small the pounding hooves stood still. I slid from the saddle and lay in the wheat, the itchy stalks poking through my shirt. Above my head, the horses panted, their bellies swelling and collapsing, their hooves pawing at the dirt.